And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where everyone's vacation is over, kind of. The NBA is approaching at some point. I don't know when. It's coming soon. Training camps are opening soon. And it is time, after many weeks, to say the three most anticipated words in the history of NBA niche podcasts. I will lower my sunglasses and say, what up, Beck?
What up? I think the best part of that intro is the niche podcast part. Like, it's a great phrase for like seven people who really think that this is a great phrase, like, or for the five guys who always hit me on Twitter with the what up Becks.
Don't play down what up Beck. What up Beck is a phenomenon.
You said niche. You're not wrong.
Steve Kerr, who you ran into, my chair keeps falling down, ran into in Dublin, tweeted what up Beck.
He did.
Upon the publication of a photograph of the two of you.
I think the two best responses to the to our Dublin, Ireland tweet with me and Steve was you. I think you just said what.
Yeah.
And my boy Tim Kawakami, who said, oh, good Lord, in a way that only Kawakami could.
I didn't see that. All right. So put him on the list now if he's going to give me a sarcastic, oh, Lord. Do you have a good vacation?
Great vacation. Ireland.
Some family time?
Yeah, family time, wife and daughter and I. It's in Ireland for about a week and a half, and then Iceland for a couple days at the end of that. Iceland, or as I like to call it, the moon. It looks like the moon. In all the best ways. It's a lunar landscape. It's incredible. It's bizarre.
Do you believe that we've been to the moon and know what it looks like? Do you believe that?
I believe we might have landed on Iceland.
Okay.
I believe in the lunar landing. I also believe that... if you wanted to fake a lunar landing, you'd go to Iceland.
Okay. I'm going to leave it there.
There's a theory.
Restful? Did you get some rest? Did you tune out?
You know, it's funny because you go overseas and, of course, immediately you now have to be like hyper-conscious of the data use. Like how often – we should not be getting on Twitter when we are away anyway.
Why don't you just get the thing where you pay like – $5 or $10, depending on I have a thing called Travel Pass where no matter what country.
I have Travel Pass. Travel Pass is like $10 a day.
Well, just suck it up for a couple days.
No. But when you're gone for 14 days,
you don't have to use it every day. Only use it when you have to.
I'm an addict.
I guess that's what you're saying.
I guess what I'm saying is I'm an addict. But no, also we were driving around Ireland, and though I did do the download Google Maps thing, very smart and important thing to know, by the way, if you're ever driving in places you don't know, and especially if there's no internet service, no cell service, or if you're abroad where it's going to cost you an arm and a leg, you download any portion of the Google Maps to your phone while you're on Wi-Fi, and you can still use it for driving directions. But I was driving around Ireland on the wrong side of the road, by the way, on the wrong side of the car, and I'm still here today. I'm alive.
I've never driven on the wrong side of the road.
Oh, God, it's horrifying.
And I don't want to. I am fine being a chicken. We went to St. John during Linsanity, actually. I missed Linsanity. I've told that story before.
Right.
We went to St. John. I believe they drive on the wrong side of the road in St. John because I didn't drive that. It was four of us, and I was like, I refuse.
In this case, it was the only way. Like, we did Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland. So we covered a lot of ground, and we went from coast to coast, essentially, as well. And Ireland is gorgeous and a lot of beautiful countryside and little towns to see. And the only way to do it, unless you're going to hop on some like ridiculous tour bus, the only way to do it is to drive yourself. So it's just sink or swim. You get in there. It's the weirdest thing. The first time you go to the car and the second and third time you go to the car, whoever's driving immediately goes to the wrong side. My wife kept going to the driver's side of the car, thinking
right.
It was the passenger side.
Right.
It's hard to break those habits. Your brain is so hardwired for this. Even when you're just standing on a sidewalk looking both ways before you cross the street, you look the wrong way every time. It's really tough. And also Ireland, all these little two-lane roads, there's like no center, not only no center median, there's barely a center line. And then on the shoulder, there's no shoulder. There's just like hedges encroaching on the road. You have the narrowest little passageway to get through at 100 kilometers an hour. People riding up on you and oncoming traffic flying at you. I was petrified. But we lived.
Well, good for you. I don't want to ever drive on the wrong side of the road, but I guess you're right. If you go to one of those countries and you have to drive somewhere, there's no other option.
Yeah.
I'll let my wife drive. She's a good driver. She's a better parallel parker than me, too, which she lords over me.
That's important in this city.
Lord, well, we don't have a car, but when we travel, she brags about her parallel parking skills.
I like her photography skills. Always these gorgeous shots on Twitter of the ocean off the coast in Croatia and the dot in the sea that is allegedly
so
you.
It's a source of not that photo, but I just don't like stopping to take photos. I just want to. I want to walk around. I want to. It's related to my hatred of Snapchat. I don't want to pause life to stop and take a picture or look at a screen. I just want to go. I want to like look around and go. And so she now just says keep walking. Like just keep walking. I'm going to stop and take a picture. I'll catch up. So now that's where we've come to. This is how marriages work.
Yes,
you compromise, and the compromise is hey. Whole husband, you just keep walking. I'm going to make the memories that you will one day cherish, but are too lazy or impatient to make with me right now.
I'm the one who, while I'm driving, I'm like, "Ooh, that's really cool. You got to shoot that out the window," and like getting my wife to shoot because I can't take my hands off the steering wheel. But we are all three shutterbugs, my wife and daughter and I. So, and now that my daughter has her own device to take photos with, so between the three of us, there's like you know three iPhones and plus a little Panasonic digital camera. And it's all we do. Like we come back from a 2-week vacation with like 3,000 photos or something that we have to somehow now edit down to put on the computer.
Yeah, so my wife and I got married 5 years ago. Still working on the wedding album. Still one day we'll get to the wedding album.
You're supposed to hire somebody to do that.
Really?
We paid one photographer. It was like we were both at the LA Daily News still. So the key thing is
spend that newspaper money. That's what it was. You had that newspaper money.
No. We're on a newspaper budget, but you get your friends, the newspaper photographers.
Oh boy,
because they're a little bit cheaper than like these professionals who just do nothing but weddings and charge you through the nose. So we got one of our colleagues to shoot it, and a different colleague who like her specialty was like putting together these amazing wedding books, and so she did our wedding book.
Well, one day we'll do it, I'm sure. I mean, if it not, I assume we still have the photos. Anyway, the NBA is not quite bad. It's actually quite dead in the NBA, and nobody is reading NBA content right now. It's like still, it's interesting. It's still, I think next week, after the Hall of Fame, people are going to start trickling back in. It's going to be, the NBA is happening. Let's think about who signed where and blah, blah, blah. But it is the Hall of Fame week.
It is.
You are going up on Friday, I believe.
Yes.
I'm going up tomorrow because someone bailed at us on our table, and I was the substitute table guy, so I'm going to be at the big ESPN table for the schmooze dinner tomorrow. I'm very excited. I've never been before.
It's great.
We have a great class. Steve Nash, Grant Hill, Jason Kidd. Who am I forgetting?
There's Ray Allen.
Ray Allen.
Maurice Cheeks.
My boy Dino Raja getting in. Ahead of Kukoc, which is interesting. I don't believe Kukoc is in.
I don't think so.
For the Croatian people. I thought, you know, all those guys are obviously deserving. I thought we could go through some people who will be or already are cantankerous Hall of Fame cases. We'll do some rapid-fire Hall of Fame talk. Because I do think the Hall of Fame is interesting, and I'm actually, you know, everyone sort of it's become consensus to sort of argue for let's abolish the Hall of Fame and start over and have an NBA only Hall of Fame. And I get that. I kind of like the international element and the pan basketball element, the all of basketball element. So I don't know. I'm a little torn. Ginobili just retired. We all agree he's in, right? He's a complete shoe-in. The interesting question that Pelton asked online is on ESPN.com is would he get in without the international accolades, which you can't say. I mean, he is one of the three or four greatest international basketball players ever in terms of not only what he is as a player in the NBA, but what he accomplished leading the Golden Generation team to a gold medal and a world championship and all that. But that's an interesting question. Should he get in based on NBA alone, if that were a thing?
If that were a thing, I think he'd have a hard case, right? Because, and this is the thing, and this is why you're right. All of us would love the kind of the purity of the argument if it were just an NBA Hall of Fame, right? It would be so much cleaner in a lot of ways, and we'd have better apples-to-apples comparisons, right? Like, it's hard to compare the international player who spent half of his career overseas and half in the NBA to the
Dino Raja.
Right. To the guy who spent all of his career in the NBA. To the guy who was a great college player but a so-so NBA player. To the all-time leading scorer in WNBA history, say, or the 10th leading scorer in WNBA history. To the coach from Botswana. I don't know. Like, there's – there are so many different categories: men, women, international, U.S., college, pro, and it's all eligible. And so there are no apples to apples comparisons
and no criteria that anyone has any idea like what it is.
Right. In baseball, it's very clean in the sense that we know that Major League Baseball is 99% of all baseball that matters. And you have all these markers like 3000 hit club and all this stuff that are kind of like these almost automatic triggers, these plateaus that you hit. In basketball, you kind of have it. Like, we can all pull up basketball reference and see, oh, everybody that's scored 25,000 points in their career is either in or almost certainly will be, right? Like, we can do that. We can look at the top 25, top 30 scorers in NBA history and almost make an assumption. But because we don't have the apples-to-apples comparison, a Manu Ginobili comes along, and you look at all the traditional stats, and you go, well, he doesn't blow you away statistically. You know, there's a case to be made that if he were like the featured player on a different team and not the Spurs teams where he was a willing sixth man for the good of a team that was a perennial contender, then he's got a different career path and he had the skill set to be a leading guy. But we don't get to do the what ifs. That's not how this works.
Two-time All-Star, very low for a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
Only played 30 minutes a game twice, although he came very close other times. Four-time champion. Matters a lot.
Matters a lot.
And his playoff numbers are fantastic across the board.
Essential to those teams, too, right? Like, this isn't a hanger-on who happened to be around for a bunch of titles. This is a guy who was an essential part of those championships.
Yeah, if you're on the Spurs, are a dynasty. They're not quite a dynasty in the way we think of this. Like for 6 years, they won 5 and 6 or something like that,
or dominated a single decade or something.
If you're on a team that wins like 4 in a row or 3 and 4 or 4 and 5 or whatever it is, if you're the third best player on that team and you're a borderline all-star or a couple times all-star, you generally have gotten in, dating to the 50s and 60s Celtics. The one interesting counterexample to that is Horace Grant. The Bulls never got the third. You can count Rodman, who is in, but the bulk of his career was with the Pistons, and then he won 3 rings with the Bulls. Horace Grant, we'll talk about him because I think he's comparable to another guy a current player who will get a sniff at least once he retires. But yeah, Manu would have, it would be, you know, no one loves Manu more than I do. I love Manu.
You wrote the definitive epic saga piece of Manu.
And there's so many good stories in there. And it's interesting because you want to talk about the sacrifice and say, well, he willingly accepted this role for the good of the team. And in the process, and I asked many of their coaches, I said, you know, he's going to finish with 13,000 points, which is like very low for a Hall of Famer. Like Andre Iguodala has 13,000 points. In 2 All-Star appearances, you know, could he have had 18,000 points and 7 All-Star appearances, in which case this isn't even a conversation? And I expected them all to say, well, of course he could have. And they all said, you know, the way he plays and just the fevered pitch and everything, we're not sure he would have stayed healthy playing 33, 34, 35 minutes a game, starting every game. He just can't dial it back. He loves to crash and collide into people. We're not sure he would have stayed healthy, which I thought was interesting.
Interesting and fair. And there's a way to use that as a means to say, well, then if that were his career, then he's probably still not a Hall of Famer because he would have been a more limited role or whatever his career would have. You know, we're in an area of complete speculation. But I think what this leads to in some ways, Zach, is that the discussion of the Hall of Fame, because it can't just be MVPs, right? It can't just be everybody who was an MVP or a 10-time All-Star. There has to be another echelon that is below the LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Shaquille O'Neal, Kobe Bryant, Steph Curry echelon, right?
Yes.
There are a bunch of guys who just were multiple-time All-Stars and really, really good, and we make the jokes about, you know, the Hall of Really Good, and you know, those were the guys who... But the real Hall of Fame involves a lot of those guys. And so when we talk about Manu Ginobili, we should talk about the sacrifice. Not because you get in the Hall of Fame based on virtue or selflessness, but because the Hall of Fame already is a collection of both the greatest of the great and some greats who were just behind those greats. See, and another tier behind that. And the guys who were the great all-time role players matter. Like, they matter to those championships. And so that's when you have to weigh in all this other stuff. And by the way, can I do my quick rant on this? This is why the opaqueness of the Hall of Fame drives me up the freaking wall. Because We don't know who votes, what basis they vote on, what their rationale is, what the standards are, how they parse out the NBA versus non-NBA stuff. And so when it comes to, let's say, Manu Ginobili a few years from now misses on the first ballot, if this were
then we riot. That's what happens. We riot. We storm the cigar smoke infested conference room where the Hall of Fame syndicate and the smoking man are hiding, and we riot. That's what we do.
All right. While we're planning for our riot, if this were baseball and that happened, we would call up all the baseball writers and say, "Hey, dude, why'd you leave Manu off the ballot?" And they would say, "Well, listen, I thought his international achievements were really compelling. I just felt like he fell short in these following areas," or, "Hey, he never averaged 30 minutes a game, or only averaged 30 minutes a game once," blah. They would tell us why, and we could disagree with it, and we could argue, and we could have all these wonderful debates, and it could fill talk shows and ESPN debate shows for days on end. But we don't even have anybody that we can ask why he didn't get it. And like Carmelo Anthony, who's another one of these polarizing cases, shouldn't be because he's automatic. But a lot of Carmelo, what makes Carmelo's case an automatic is his national championship at Syracuse and his 3 gold medals. Like, those alone, plus being one of the all-time great scorers in the NBA, will do it. And we can all pick apart Carmelo's game, and I will. But I'm just saying, if Carmelo, whether he gets in or doesn't, I want to be able to ask somebody who was influential in that, "Hey, how much did the Syracuse National Championship matter? How much did the Olympic gold medals matter? How much did you consider 4 straight years in his prime when he couldn't get the Knicks to the playoffs?"
We're also at the point where, like, I can't even keep track of whose national championships still count and whose have been vacated due to scandal. Like, I really, like, we're going to talk about Weber.
Yeah.
And I have always been pro Weber getting in and the Fab Five is an iconic, you know, I wanted to be in the Fab Five. Everyone my age thought the Fab Five was the coolest thing in the world. And then you remember, like, oh, they got, like, I don't exactly remember what happened, but there was a booster and they got stripped of a lot. Like, I don't even know how many wins the Fab Five has anymore.
I know. It's maddening. And then it's also, does Chris Webber's case get strengthened by what they achieved, or does his case get weakened by being part of that scandal and associated with it? I don't even know.
Let's not do Webber yet.
All right, but again, if there were somebody that we could ask, "Hey, did that matter one way or the other?" But we can't, because there's nobody to ask. It's all opaque. It's crap. It's utter bullshit that a Hall of Fame with the importance that it conveys doesn't have any accountability whatsoever.
Manu's getting in. That's the end of the story.
Yes.
I want to do this one more as a setup to the next one, because Carmelo's getting in. It's funny how many blog posts I've read in the last 2 months that are like, should Carmelo get in? And it's like a round table and everyone says, yes, this is a stupid argument. And like, the blog post ends up arguing against its own existence. Like, so
because this time of year, all we have is to say are Carmelo and Dwight Hall of Famers? What was everybody's NBA 2K score and how mad are they about it?
Oh my God.
NBA rank. You guys will start your NBA rank charade pretty soon here and everybody can
charade.
I mean,
I'll tell you right now, we have our summit coming up in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Our NBA summit. It was a source of some consternation last year, the NBA rank. Yeah. There was some tense moments in the summit. Particularly, I believe, surrounding DeMar DeRozan's rank. I think he came in the 60s. There was some tension in the room.
It's a great exercise and it's a great discussion point, but I say sure just because ESPN is masterful at this. You trot out the rank day by day, piece by piece. Everybody freaks out about it. It feeds the ESPN talk shows for at least a 24-hour cycle. The players themselves, because they'll get offended, they're going to create all this free publicity because they're all going to bitch about it on Twitter. It's great. It's beautiful. But this is how we kill all the dead time in the summer.
I'm glad you brought up Dwight, because everyone does the same thing with Dwight that I just described with Carmelo, which is, this is stupid. You're stupid. Why are you bringing this up? He's automatically in. And I wanted to just sort of reexamine that, because we're now on 5 teams that have had an acrimonious Dwight Howard exit, and would not take him back if they could. And he's never been the same since the back and shoulder injuries started popping up before he went to Los Angeles, although he was better with the Lakers than people remember, and better with the Rockets, including during their playoff run, than people remember. And like, it's not going to be a 12 to 13 year period of sustained dominance, and the end of his career is going poorly. I was open to it. He's going to get in. It's the end of the story. 8-time All-Star. His 5-year peak from 08 to 12 was just absolutely monstrous. And this is the clincher. Not forget the 3-time defensive player of the year, 4 top 5 MVP finishes, 8 all NBA appearances, including 5 on the first team. You just don't keep that player out. It just doesn't, none of it, those numbers are unassailable.
Yeah. So here's my, and I'm with you on this, right? Like,
And I wanted to give it a shot. Wanted to give it a shot. It's not there.
Dwight is in. Carmelo's in. These aren't really arguable, but for the sake of making arguments anyway, because even if they're inarguable, I just want to say this, because I'm with you on this. One of the things that I think we both hate about the Twitter conversation on things like this is the people just getting like bullied and laughed off the stage. How dare you even suggest that Dwight's not a Hall of Famer? How dare you even, you're an idiot. You don't know anything about basketball if you think this. And of course that goes both directions, but too often the basketball intelligentsia weighs in with a very heavy hand on this stuff that does drive me up the wall, because there's a counter argument to be made for both these guys. It doesn't mean that the counter argument will hold sway. And the history of the Hall of Fame, based on everybody who is in, suggests to us very strongly that these guys are in based on the standards as we know them. We don't know what those standards are, but based on who is in, these
and
guys
also,
should be.
And also, one of my least favorite Hall of Fame things, and it's something you can't not do because every precedent does matter, but is saying, whenever I do it too, whenever, so, well, Ralph Sampson's in, then this guy has to be in. Well, yeah. Lowest Hall of Famer, this guy's better. I don't know that because that guy's in, we now have to let everyone else that's better than him in.
Yeah. No, and
Ralph Sampson shouldn't be in, by the way. I'm sorry. He shouldn't be in.
Yeah. And there are a bunch of guys in there who shouldn't be. And if we use them as the barometer, then yeah. Based on all standards that we're aware of that we can define based on who's in, Dwight will be in. But I want to defend the people who make the counter argument in the sense that there is a counter argument to be made, or at least a discussion to be had. And here's the discussion, and you alluded to it at the outset. He's on his 5th team in 7 years, and every single one of those changes has been because they just couldn't wait to get rid of him. Yeah, like, granted,
with the exception of the Lakers.
The Lakers wanted him back, but it was more like the Lakers had entered desperation times.
Kobe was going to teach him how to win games. Remember, that was the line. I'm going to teach you how to win. That went over well.
And they made a big trade to get him, and they you know, complicated that by them trading away first-round picks for Steve Nash. And like, they were in a different mode. But still, there's an element of the Lakers, for certain, that was kind of like, okay, yeah, fine. We're at least cleared of that headache. It brings up this question, which is, how long do you need to be dominant for to be a Hall of Famer? And there's somebody else on your list that we discussed via email that we'll get to later who also fits into this category. But it's, how long do you need to be dominant? So with Dwight, there's a 6-year run in Orlando where he's absolutely a terror, right? Especially as a rebounder and shot blocker. But even, you know, scoring-wise, he's in the 20s, you know, 18, 22-9. And it's not a clean break from when he leaves Orlando, right? Like, it's not a complete fall off. He does have
17 and 12 in his first year in LA.
17 and 12, and 12.4 rebounds a game in his first year in LA, or his only year in LA. And that led the league that year. So he was also that was his 5th rebounding title. Another thing that I think does matter. But his run of dominance is 6 years for sure in Orlando. If you want to tack on the 7th year in L.A., though there were also issues with that, fine. But then he's only 28 by the time he gets to Houston. 28. This is supposed to be the middle of your prime.
His body just...
Partially his body, but a lot was his attitude, Zach. We all know this. Like, so much of this was about feed me the ball in the post, play through me, I'm a number one option, I don't want to just set screens and then dive to the basket, even though that's what I did best in Orlando. Shaq got in his head.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
I haven't read everything because I was on vacation, but I've read a lot. I'm a little bit surprised how many people think he is indisputably an upgrade for Washington over Marcin Gortat. Like, he's better. He's a better rebounder. He won't get pushed around enough. But March is one of the best screen setters in the entire NBA, and with the exception of, you know, and look, he was unhappy in the locker room. They had to move him. It became untenable. But he did his job. That's all he did. He didn't ask for 20 post-ups a game, and, like, I don't know what's going to happen when Dwight asks for 10 or 12 post-ups a game.
And how many times have we heard him say, you know...
And he's immobile. Defensively, right. He is immobile. Yeah. Immobile. He cannot come out above the foul line. Not that Gortat is prime KG, but I don't think, given role and skill set, that Dwight's superior rebounding and superior athleticism, I don't think it's a no-brainer clear upgrade for the Wizards.
No, not at all. And especially considering that the reason you moved Marcin Gortat was because of chemistry concerns. Now you're bringing in Dwight, who is on his fifth team in 7 years because of chemistry concerns at every place he's been. So my question for the Hall of Fame debate, to the extent that there is a case for people who are the anti-Dwight camp, it's fair to point out that starting in the middle of his prime at age 28, every team kept passing him off to the next one.
We'll take a Plumlee. What do we need to get rid of Dwight?
Right. That matters to me, Zach. Like, that should matter. I'm not saying that the 7 year period that has followed his dominant years, I'm not saying that negates how great he was in that 6 year run in Orlando. I'm just saying that it's fair to wonder how much that should count, because he's going to play another 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and we're going to have a good decade plus of him being considered a malcontent, a bad chemistry guy, a guy who always, you know, thought he should be doing more than he was.
I'll tell you what's going to happen in those whatever amount of years. He will cross into the 20,000 point, 10,000 rebound club, a club that currently has 18 members only. All of them are in the Hall of Fame or are active players that will be in the Hall of Fame, Pau Gasol and Dirk Nowitzki being the act, and then Tim Duncan will make it, obviously. So they're all Hall of Famers. All 18 are Hall of Famers. He's going to cross over, and it's going to be interesting to see how, because players started to enter the league earlier and because health and longevity have improved, how or if the Hall of Fame begins to recalibrate. The Hall of Fame, the cigarette smoking room.
I like that the cigarette the man himself,
CSM,
from the X-Files.
CSM is in there. And I didn't watch. I don't know how the X-Files ended, by the way. What happened?
It's a complicated question because it ended.
I was out.
Mulder was still like up on a spaceship somewhere. But then they had the movie, which was not good.
The first movie was good.
Oh, right. Wait,
the second movie is so bad. That I saw it with one of my friends. Shout out to Kerry Scott, a great artist. X-Files fans, we saw it together. And our consensus walking out was that Chris Carter intentionally made the worst possible X-Files movie because he just never wanted to see all these people again and wanted to. It was like so terrible.
And then they brought it back.
I didn't watch. Yeah, they had the recent run, which people thought was good.
Yeah, they did. And I meant to watch it and didn't.
Do the aliens come or not? I don't remember. Anyway.
I think they're already here, Zach.
Yes. So, It will be interesting to see if Cigarette Smoking Man and his friends at the Hall of Fame, the statistical milestones. So I'll give you another name that's going to cross into that 2010 club very soon. Zach Randolph. Mm. I don't think anyone would argue that Zach Randolph is a Hall of Famer.
No.
Two-time All-Star, one All-NBA appearance.
Here's a question. Let's step back for a second and ponder this philosophical matrix. What is a Hall of Famer? Like, if we just throughout the idea that, well, if you get 25,000 points or if you finish in the 2010 club, what I was trying to come up with this because you sent me this list of names and my eyes are glazing over as I'm going through basketball references. And I'm trying to think, like, for some of these guys, the numbers alone don't tell enough of a story. And so I was trying to figure out, like, what does it mean to be a Hall of Famer? Like, what should we define it as in the abstract? And I think it's that you can't tell the story of a specific era, and an era maybe 5 years, maybe 10, without that player. That player is essential to the story of that era. That's one way of looking at this.
I like that.
And by that standard, Carmelo Anthony, even if you don't like the fact that he doesn't pass the ball. But even if you didn't like that he doesn't pass the ball or he doesn't play defense or that he didn't get the Knicks anywhere or that they missed four straight playoff runs or missed the playoffs 4 straight years, whatever you might say about him, Carmelo Anthony's essential to defining that era. And put up numbers, right? You can't say, like, Nick Young, somebody might say, well, we'll never, you know, forget what he did with the Lakers because
Nick Young
heavily
is featuring in a project I'm running next week that's Hall of Fame related, by the way.
So there are characters that we could say helps define an era, but you're not in on being a character alone is what I'm saying. I just like a quick little asterisk there to help define this. But you can't tell the story of a certain era without Dwight Howard and the dominant runs in Orlando and taking them to the finals besides. And we're going to get to Chauncey later. You can't tell the story of that era without those Pistons teams going back to back.
Let's just do the Pistons now. You brought it up. The Pistons have that Pistons team that made 6 straight conference finals, one of my favorite teams, has no Hall of Famers.
Correct. Yet.
I wonder if the most likely outcome is that they finish with no Hall of Famers. if you had to pick one, and there are four guys that people will make arguments for that are core members of that Pistons team. Apologies to Tayshaun Prince. If you had to pick one, who you think should or does, I don't pick whatever your standard is. Who gets in? If you had to pick one, because I think they might get zero for a while and then someone will get in later.
Which, by the way, brings up one of my other Hall of Fame rants.
You're either in or you're out.
Yeah, the first ballot thing is stupid. God, can we just stop using that phrase?
Oh, that guy's a first ballot Hall of Famer. You know what they should do? They should, okay, how about this? They should have this, there should be, you should be able to waive the five, Tim Duncan should go right to the Hall of Fame. But like, I think there should be a certain class of players that the 5-year waiting period doesn't apply. I don't know what the criteria would be. I just know Tim Duncan should just get in the Hall of Fame. He should have the star next to his name on Basketball Reference now.
Yeah, no question. But the first ballot thing is stupid because once you're in and nobody, there's not a wing of the Hall of Fame like, here's where we put the third ballot Hall of Famers. Here's where we put the guys who got voted in by the Veterans Committee. It's asinine. Chauncey is the one. To me, the two guys who are the first two considerations for the Pistons are Chauncey and Ben Wallace. And Chauncey's the engine of that team. I think Chauncey is the conscience of that team. He's the guy, obviously, who won MVP during the one championship year in 2004. And yet Chauncey himself, broadly speaking, has a really weird. How about this? This is one of the strangest things in the world, by the way. And I'm sure this has happened before, and somebody out there in Twitter world will find it for me. Do you know when Chauncey's first All-Star game was? Don't look at your computer.
No, I'm checking Dennis Rodman's stats for reasons that probably are obvious. I'm going to say 07.
Yeah, so 06.
06.
So he wins Finals MVP in 2004, 2 years before he's ever even an All-Star, and then goes on to make the All-Star team seven times. And by that time, he's already mid-career. Like, Chauncey, like, talk about your late bloomers. And that's, of course, the story of his career. And it's one of the things that makes him such a fascinating player. And he's one of I did a quick Google search, and it brought me to an NBA Reddit page that I assume they've got this right, that the only other Finals MVP
Cedric Maxwell,
to not be in the Hall of Fame. The others are all guys who will because they're still active.
Another case, Duncan Kobe. I want to talk about, Andre Iguodala.
Right. So there are guys who are still active, so we're not to them yet.
But so we could get to, however, this in 10 years, right now, the people who think Chauncey should get in could say, well, look, only one Finals MVP is not in. But in 10 years, we could have three Finals MVPs that are not in, and all of a sudden it doesn't look so silly for a Finals MVP to not be in.
What if Kawhi's never the same and you have a fourth Finals MVP who's not in?
Wow. Just writing off Toronto Kawhi.
If.
Howard Beck writing off the Raptors.
They'll believe it.
Of course they will. They're the spooky molder of the fans of the NBA.
How many X-Files references can we jam into one podcast?
I used to love the X-Files. And I don't know how it ends. It makes me sad.
This is why I was late to The Sopranos. Because at the time that The Sopranos was actually on the air, we were X-Files devotees. We were watching The X-Files every Sunday night when Sopranos was on. I also don't think I had HBO yet. And so I watched The Sopranos like 10 years later.
People, football is back. That means you have home games to go to, and SeatGeek, as always, is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to every game. Whether it's a last-minute deal, you're planning a night out, you want to go to a comedy show, a concert. They helped me get tickets to Hamilton recently. I mean, they're the easiest and smartest way to buy tickets. You know, I like things that help me save time, and buying tickets used to stress me out because I used to go to 14 different websites. Did I go there? Then SeatGeek collates everything at one place. It grades every ticket based on value and seat location, whether it's an undermarket deal, whether it's an overmarket high price deal. It has a color coded system that's easy to use. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. It has tickets to everything. It makes your life easier. Use SeatGeek, download the app. And right now, best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. That's nothing to sneeze at for a game. All you got to do is download that app, enter promo code LOW. That's my last name, L-O-W-E, LOW. Promo code LOW for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. We were talking about Chauncey.
Right.
Chauncey, I'm going to disagree with you. I think if one Piston should get in from that team, it's Ben Wallace. and I'm going to disagree with myself. I'm fairly, if you ask me, who was the best player on the Pistons? The best player, period. Both during their time in Detroit and just overall. One game, who's the best player? It's Sheed. Sheed is
the best
player.
No. That's true. I agree.
Do you know how many All-NBA teams, not first team All-NBAs, first, second, or third, how many Sheed made? Guess.
All-NBA teams.
All-NBA.
It might be zero.
Zero!
All right, but so here's something fascinating.
He can't get in. You can't. Well, I'm not going to say you can't. It's shocking that Sheed never, like, walked into a third team All-NBA.
We talk about Manu and the sacrifice. Rasheed Wallace might have sacrificed, in my time covering the NBA, which starts in 97.
Sacrificed a lot of money.
Sacrificed a lot of money, too. But in my time covering the NBA, let's put aside Rasheed's antics on the court and all the technical fouls and suspensions and all that stuff. Brilliant freaking player. An incredibly talented player. But a guy who, when I started covering the league or those first few years, the power forwards back then, Rasheed Wallace, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett, Chris Webber, Karl Malone is still wrecking people. Antonio McDice comes along and he has some prime years in there. Tail end of Sean Kemp's career. Power forward was freaking loaded. And Rasheed Wallace, I believe at the time that he and Duncan and Garnett were all young and just kind of coming into their own, and granted, Duncan got to the championship very quickly, but Rasheed had as much or more talent than any of them. And if you ask around, you ask guys who played in that era, I think Robert Ory and I had this discussion a couple of times, Rasheed was as good as any. And at time, there was a point where people thought Rasheed could play small forward because he had some perimeter abilities too. It might have been a stretch, but people certainly posited that. But Rasheed never wanted to be the go-to guy. And you saw that with some of those Trailblazer teams that he was an essential part of. And certainly that Game 7 collapse that Blazer fans are now already like cursing my name for bringing up.
I lost a lot of money. I lost money on that game back when I gambled and every now and then.
So Rasheed was incredible. Inside, outside, defensively, smart as hell. So you want to talk about sacrifice. There's a guy who, because I think he really just frankly didn't want it, didn't want the spotlight, didn't want all the shots, didn't want to play that role. And so in Detroit, he's part of an ensemble, and it was perfect for him. And my one counter to the Ben – I've got two counters to Ben. Should we go back to Ben Wallace?
Yeah, well, let me just back my – before you knock it down.
Yeah.
He never averaged 10 points a game, nor did Rodman. Rodman is a two-time All-Star, obviously a many-time champion, five-time champion, I believe. Ben Wallace is a four-time All-Star, four-time Defensive Player of the Year. Only two guys have won four Defensive Player of the Year. The other is Mutombo. Mutombo, by the way, eight-time All-Star. I forgot how many All-Star games Mutombo made. Five-time All-NBA, Ben Wallace. And three of those are second team, which is like third team NBA. It's almost like it's still big. It's still big. Third team's still big. Second team, first team is like holy grail. You start piling up first teams like Dwight did. That's holy grail. Chauncey made one more All-Star team and two fewer All-NBA teams. I just think the four-time Defensive Player of the Year and the Rodman precedent now being there. Now, Rodman was a better rebounder and a more versatile positional defender, I think. I mean, Rodman, prime Rodman was an absolute menace. Yeah. I think Ben Wallace will get in one day.
He should. My counter on Ben Wallace is this. There's the short one and a little longer one. The short one is this. What made the Pistons great defensively, in a lot of respects, was the tag team of the two Wallaces, of Rasheed and Ben together. Because Rasheed had all the height and length that Ben Wallace did not, because Ben Wallace was, you know, incredibly undersized, which is part of what made him such an incredible player, right? That he was, giving up so many inches to every other center in the league, but he was strong as hell, and he was active, and he was a pest, and he had, you know, some leaping ability, but he made up for his lack of height in other ways. But Rasheed, in concert with Ben Wallace, that's where you're able to cover all that much more ground. And it was the two of them together, I feel like, that made this tangle
plus,
of defense.
Plus Tayshaun on the wing. Plus Tayshaun was... The guards were solid. You know,
yeah.
Rip and Chauncey were at least solid when they cared.
No, Chauncey was a two-time all-defensive player. So I do think that part of Ben Wallace's effectiveness in those Detroit years had to do with being part of that ensemble and also playing side-by-side with Rasheed Wallace, who's one of the best defenders at his position of the era. So that's one thing. The second thing with Ben Wallace, when it comes to like just the general Hall of Fame candidacy, Obviously, the stats don't leap out offensively. You know, we tend to be very much points and assists and driven.
He was not as good of a pass. I remember him as a better ball mover than the numbers would suggest.
Yeah. Maybe.
No, I'm wrong. My memory is wrong. Oh, okay. I'm sure there's one pass or something that stuck in my head. I remembered him as a better ball mover than he apparently was.
My general description of Ben Wallace over the years has been this, that I think he might have the single-handedly, for a guy who at least is a Hall of Fame discussion point, has one of the weirdest career arcs in history. He entered the league in 96. From 1996 to 2001, 5 years, he's basically nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about him. He was undrafted. He gets passed around. In 2001-02, he leads the league in rebounds for the first time, 13 rebounds a game, and then leads the league in blocks that year, too, 3.5 a game. So 01-02 is his breakout year. From 01-02 to 2006, it's another five-year span, he's a wrecking ball. And he's part of that Pistons crew that we're talking about. He wins a championship. They go to back-to-back finals. He wins all those Defensive Player of the Year awards. And then from 2006 to 2012, he's essentially a nobody again. Now, granted, he still put up some rebounding and block shot numbers the first year or so in Chicago, but the arc is just...
It's weird.
It's really weird.
As is Chauncey's.
And it goes back to my earlier thing about, like, how long do you have to be dominant for? What sustained period of excellence do we demand of a Hall of Famer? Because Yao Ming went in, again... International thing. It's complicated because of Yao Ming's international influence and what that meant to basketball. But Yao Ming's dominance in the NBA was, you know, an eye blink.
I think part of it, I don't think the Hall of Fame should shy away from subjective criteria like style and transcendent sort of memorable traits. Like, I think that's one of the reasons that Ginobili should get in, is because if you did stuff that made people say, I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
And other people try to start doing that. I think for something like this, which this is a museum, I think that matters. And that's why I unfortunately think guys like Elton Brand are disadvantaged, because they're sort of workmanlike, plodding around. And now Elton was an amazing player before his Achilles tear. He's not going
to
get in.
That goes back to the Zach Randolph example you brought up. If he's going to go 2010, but we're not going to think of him. Now, he was part of some memorable teams in Memphis, but those Memphis teams didn't do anything. So it came to, like, when I was trying to define what's a Hall of Famer. And I said, you know, look, if you were an essential part of an era, like the story of that era can't be told without you, then that's at least a starting point for a discussion. I also jotted this down when I was looking over Ben Wallace's stuff, which is that if your stats aren't the typical Hall of Fame stats, or the number of years feel a little bit short or something, as is the case for him, those things can be lower if you're part of something special.
Yeah.
Some special moment, some special team, and in his case, absolutely that's the case.
Let's go to the opposite kind of case. In a Hall of Fame case that I think is going to drive people nuts when it opens. And that's Joe Johnson. 7-time All-Star. I believe all but two guys who have made 7 All-Star teams are in, that are eligible. Larry Faust and somebody I'm forgetting. Some of them get in late, like JoJo White had to wait till 3 years ago to get in, and Chet Walker had to wait a long time to get in. Joe Johnson has 20,400 points. Everyone over 20,000, but Tom Chambers is in, I think, that's eligible. Something like that. I'll look it up while we do this. And again, 7-time All-Star. There's going to be a groundswell of people who look at those numbers and think Joe Johnson. And also, to his credit, one of the greatest clutch shooters in regular season games in literally the history of the league. His clutch, there was the 1 year in Brooklyn where he was like 8-for-9 on shots in the last 30 seconds of close games. Like, just insane.
Right. A stat that we only know these days because of all the tracking data we have, but.
If he gets in over Weber, the smell test isn't right on Joe Johnson, and part of it is that I believe he only made the conference finals twice, one at the very beginning of his career with Phoenix and one at the very end of his career last year with Houston when he didn't do anything, which I don't count. Like, I don't care that Mitch Richmond won a championship, and we're going to talk about – and to me, I think the precedent for Joe Johnson in a lot of ways, that letting – not letting – admitting Mitch Richmond, I think, is going to be a precedent that gets cited a lot because he had a totally unremarkable postseason career. He did average 20 points a game. I looked it up for 10 years in a row, which is really hard. He made 6 All-Star teams, a bunch of All-NBA teams, 5, I think. Maybe 6. No, 5. I guess I do feel like, and again, it's hard to credit or blame individual players for how far their teams get or what kinds of opportunities they had to shine on the biggest and brightest stages. But it means more to me if conference finals and finals, appearing in those multiple times and doing well makes up for some regular season shortcomings to me. And Mitch Richmond had none of that and got in. The other thing with Joe Johnson, people are going to cite the 7-time All-Star. It's practically his name now is 7-time All-Star Joe Johnson. We're going to need to, we're going to, in 5 years, we're going to have to zoom out and create a multiplier that, like, an Eastern Conference All-Star appearance from, like, 1995 to 2020 is going to count for, like, 0.65 of a Western Conference All-Star appearance. But no, it really matters. Like, Chris Webber is a 5-time All-Star. It will get held against him. When his time, it's now here. We're here. When his time is here. Well, that's pretty low. Yeah, he was in the Western Conference in the late 90s and 2000s when Dirk and Timmy and KG and all these, like, it was a monster conference.
And Karl Malone.
And Joe Johnson. Yeah. Joe Johnson made an all-star team for the Nets, averaging 15 points a game, made an all-star team. I remember picking my all-stars and being like, oh, man, I guess Joe Johnson. I got 10 guys. Who else is here? It's just they're not equivalent. And another guy... I've said before that he's in. It's a no-brainer that he's in. I still think it's interesting that the multiplier should apply to is Chris Bosh. Chris Bosh is an 11-time All-Star. Automatically in. Just no, forget the championships. 11-time All-Star, you're in. Well, he's like 12th all-time in All-Star appearances. How many All-NBA teams do you think Chris Bosh made? First, second, or third? How many?
3?
1.
Wow.
That blew me away that Chris Bosh made 1 all. I'm going to check it again now because I'm still afraid it's wrong as I'm looking at. I'm looking at Basketball Reference, 1 all NBA team. If he hadn't played in the East, all NBA second team, 2007, if he hadn't played in the East and he were 6-time All-Star Chris Bosh, it's a totally different conversation.
Yeah, it is.
Joe Johnson does not pass the Hall of Fame smell test. I'm sorry.
So Joe Johnson, it goes back to some of my more general squishy definitions that I was trying to create. You know, can we tell the story of the mid-2000s to the mid-2010s? I don't know what the hell the whatever that is. Can we tell it without Joe Johnson?
Yeah.
I mean, where's the defining moment, the defining team that he anchored, the defining style, the defining anything? What, aside from great numbers... And he had great numbers. And as you point out, he was a phenomenal clutch shooter for a period of time, too. And he anchored some pretty good Hawks teams. A bunch of very nice, solid Hawks teams. I would have loved to have seen the alternate universe where Robert Sarver doesn't go cheap and let Joe Johnson leave.
True.
Because True. Joe Johnson Fair. With Phoenix was great.
Then we're talking about more conference finals appearances, probably everything I said.
Yeah, and maybe the Suns get to the finals, by the way. If he doesn't break his face the 1 year, the Suns may get to the finals. But Joe Johnson has, in this universe...
1 All-NBA appearance. Joe Johnson's out. I'm sorry. Yeah. He has 1 third-team All-NBA appearance. He's going to pile up, but he's going to get votes. If there are votes, he's going
to
get some.
Right. And then I'll go back to ranting about, well, we won't know what those votes are, right? Like, you're either in or you're not. We don't get a vote total or how close you got because this is, again, it's the NBA and it's a Basketball Hall of Fame and it's completely opaque. We'll never know how many votes he got or why he got them or why he didn't get them.
If you line up, so everyone knows I've caped for Weber to get in before.
And he should be.
Well, I wish it were a stronger case. So Weber is 17,000 points. Which is about, you know, Amari Sotomayor's got 16,000. We could talk about him. Marion's got 17,000. We could talk about him if you want. He's a 5-time All-Star, like I said, lower than some of these other guys. 5-time All-NBA, one of which is a first-team All-NBA. I think that you could argue there was like a 3-year window, maybe a 2-year window from like 2000 to 2002. When Weber was the best power forward in the NBA. It was close. Now, if you count Duncan as a center. Look, the advanced stats you can use or whatever, his player efficiency rating, 20.5 for his career, is higher than the rest of these guys. I'm sorry, Chris Webber was his combination of counting stats and style and advanced stats and is like, it's just better than these other guys to me. It's a little bit better than Sean Marion, who's a four-time All-Star and made two All-NBA teams. It's a little bit better than Amari Stoudemire, who's a six-time All-Star, one more than Weber, made five All-NBA teams, none of which was a third team. That's impressive. Could not guard you or me and could not pass to anybody and was to some degree dependent on Steve Nash to create easy offense for him anyway. Weber just – to me, Weber's better than those guys. It's not clear-cut. You could very easily make the case that Weber falls into that same bucket of Marion and Joe Johnson and Amari and whoever else you want to throw in it as borderline guys, and he's borderline. I think he's a little better. I just think there was a time where you watched Chris Weber play and you said, I don't think I've seen anybody play quite like that.
No, he was incredible. And I went through that list earlier, right? And I think I left Dirk out the first time. I'm sorry, Dirk. That era of power forwards, including Duncan, who was a power forward in that era. You know, David Robinson is still alive and kicking then. Duncan, Rasheed, Dirk, Karl Malone, Chris Webber, Kevin Garnett. And that's why, one of the reasons why he doesn't have as many All-Star nods or even All-NBA nods.
We need the multiplier, I'm telling you.
I think we do. Here's something from, again, thank you to Basketball Reference for being able to do this so easily. From 1994 to 2006. That's a long freaking stretch. We talk about longevity, and I talk about guys whose Hall of Fameness is limited to about 5 or 6 years of their career. Chris Webber, from 1994 to 2006, bridging from Washington to Sacramento, averages 22 points, 10 rebounds, 4.5 assists, 1.5 steals, 1.4 blocks. Those are great numbers for a 5 or 6 year run. He did that from 94 to 06. That's a 12-year run at 22 points, 10 rebounds, 4.4 assists, 1.5 steals.
He's one of the greatest passing big men in the history of the league.
Yes, and so now listen, the bias built in by what you saw firsthand plays a factor here for me, because I was covering the Lakers then, and there's all those Laker Kings matchups that I saw regular season and playoffs, and Chris Webber was phenomenal, and I saw more of him than a lot of guys because of that. But he was the fulcrum of that Kings team. They were kind of an ensemble cast with Vlade and Doug Christie and Peja and Bibby and all that. But Chris Webber, to me, is the guy who defined those teams for all the above reasons. He revived that team, by the way. He made the Kings relevant for the first time in their Sacramento history. And look at their win totals over a four-year run. Starting in 2001, they go from 55 to 61, 50, 59, 55. That's a four-year run where they're a dominant team. And this isn't a
And this, by the way, we cannot have this discussion without at least mentioning that it's entirely different if Game 6 goes differently.
In 2002.
Yeah. Yeah. Then they have a ring. And he's in.
And he's already in. Yeah. Yes. If Game 6 goes differently, forget that matter. If Game 7 goes differently. Like, I know everybody's going to like do the whole Game 6 thing again. They had a chance at Game 7 at home, and Webber and all of the rest of them all gagged.
It was a bad game. And Webber, I went back and I watched like every big Chris Webber playoff game for the piece I did for Granlin on him. His playoff record is both better than people remember it as, and his performance is 8 to 10% worse versus the regular season. Both of those things are true.
So the Western Conference back then is absolutely brutal. You have the Kings, the Spurs, the Lakers, the Trailblazers, the Mavericks during their Nash, Nowitzki, Finley era. Here's something I came across. 2002, the Western Conference final standings in 01-02, the Kings led the West, led the NBA with 61 wins, followed by the Lakers and Spurs with 58 each, Dallas at 57, Minnesota at 50, Portland in sixth place at 49. The winner of the Eastern Conference that year was the Nets with 52 wins.
Made the finals one year with 49 wins, yeah, I think.
The Nets would have been sixth in the West that year. So the West is an absolute murderer's row. And Chris Webber's anchoring a Kings team that is in the thick of it year in, year out, and makes the conference finals infamously and famously in 2002, made at least the semis three other times, You point out his point total. Like, he's 91st in NBA history in points, not counting the ABA. But he's ahead of James Worthy, who's in. Tiny Archibald, who's in.
Yeah, I mean, you can play that game for Stoudemire and Marion, too. Yeah. Marion has more points than Weber.
But all right, Grant Hill is right behind Chris Weber in career points. Grant Hill is going in on Friday. Why is Grant Hill in and Chris Weber is not?
Well,
but not by based
Grant
on
Hill
points
in his
alone,
prime was a better all-around player than Chris Weber.
And that prime did not last that long because of injuries.
Right.
Grant Hill, again.
And he's one of the greatest college players of all time.
When we drag the smoking man into the room to ask him, I want to know how much of Grant Hill's Hall of Fame decision was based on Duke, was based on international play, was based on anything else. Because his NBA career, while it started out as next Michael Jordan, you know, perennial all-star, everything else, I mean, the injuries cut him way short. So, Chris Webber should be in, period.
He finished in MVP voting 7th, 9th, 4th, 7th, and 10th. Five top 10 appearances in MVP voting. That's right on the border.
That's Webber you're talking about.
Marion finished in the top 10 once. So to me, if I had to go rapid fire, Weber in, Marion out, and I love Marion. Marion, when I did that Weber article, Marion was the other guy I was like, I want to dive in and make the case for Sean Marion. Because you know me, I love defense and switchability and all around players, and he is a champion with the Mavs. Yeah. It was fantastic in that series, played 35 minutes a game. He's not quite transcendent enough at his prime. He was always the third best player on the Phoenix teams behind Amari and Nash.
Yeah.
I'm out on Marion. It hurts me to say because I really love Sean Marion's game. I'm just out.
I agree. And that's the thing. If you're comparing like Weber and Marion, you know, I think Weber did more, but also you could build a team around him. You weren't going to build a team around Sean Marion. You loved having him on your team as that third guy, but you're not building a team around him. And the Suns, for that 5-6 year stretch that they were great and went to three conference finals, it was because of Nash and Amari primarily. And Sean Marion was essential to them, but not as essential as Nash and Amari. He doesn't define that team in the same way that those two guys do, or the way that Chris Weber defined those Kings teams.
Amari has an interesting case. Six-time All-Star, 5 All-NBA appearances, again, first team and 4 second teams. 16,000 points, which gets you in the ballpark. Some of his advanced stats are higher than Weber's, some are not, depending on whether PER, VORP, or wins above replacement are your taste. He finished in the top 10 in MVP voting 4 times, which is what I just said. Weber was, I think, the same, or 5 maybe for Weber. Let me see what the highest one of those was. I like to see when guys get into like the top 3. Yeah, he was 9th, 6th, 10th, and 9th. And obviously, he had one great year in New York, and then his body and his career fell apart, as the Suns predicted it would, in letting him go. I think when you consider... He wasn't one-dimensional, because he was one of the most, I mean, prime Amari was an absolute wrecker on offense. Like, there was not a guy who could dive to the rim like that in the whole league, in the whole world. I mean, he was just a wrecker. He could face up. He could go off the dribble. He could hit a little mid-range jumper. So I don't want to say he's one-dimensional, but Nash helped him a lot, and the on-off numbers will show it. By the way, I checked them today. The Suns were a minus almost every year in Amari's prime when Nash was on the bench. His shooting numbers are still all right, but they were worse. I just think he was not a good rebounder. He was an awful defensive player, awful for his entire career, and didn't really bring much in passing and creating for others. I think I'm out on Amari.
Fair.
You're in. You're going to be in.
No,
I can see it.
His everything that you just articulated at the front end of that is why I would be tempted to put him in. Things do fall off prematurely for him, but look, we've already gone through guys like Ben Wallace who only had like 6 dominant years, or Dwight with his 7 dominant years or whatever.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. You can pick which players to compare. If you tell me Amari, Ben Wallace, I mean, Ben Wallace has the 4 defensive player of the years and a championship. That's the difference.
They're inverses of each other.
They really are.
In offensively,
I didn't think about them together. That's fun.
But it goes back to, with Amari, it also goes back to, you know, one of my nice squishy definitions, which is you can't tell the story of the 2005 to 2012, whatever the cutoff is, era without talking about the Suns, the most enjoyable team of that era.
Well, but Nash is in.
And Nash.
And I bet D'Antoni gets in.
Mike will absolutely get in. So Mike and Steve Nash together are the ones who create this new, you know, the entire model that now is now the dominant model of the NBA. So they changed the game. They did it together. It's Mike's approach and Steve Nash's talent that does that. But Steve Nash isn't doing that without Amari and Sean Marion and certainly a bunch of other guys, right? The Suns were a collection. But at the core of that are really two guys. It is Nash and Amari. All that was great and all that was deficient about those Suns teams, amazing offensively, spectacular to watch, and deficient defensively, that describes those two players. And I don't know that you have, you know, it's a little bit like Stockton and Malone, where it's kind of hard to separate their success. They're so interdependent.
I think I'm out. You're not swaying me.
I was close. You were leaning for a bit. But you can't tell the story of that era of the NBA without the Suns, who make three conference finals, who average, you know, whatever.
And again, who
wins.
Knows what the discussion is if Robert Horry doesn't hip check Steve Nash and everyone doesn't come off the bench and yada, yada, yada.
Right. Or if Joe Johnson doesn't break his face in the other run.
07, I think, was the hip check, right?
Yeah. That sounds right. And the broken face, Joe Johnson's broken face was 05?
Steve Nash played with a broken face so many times. I was going through Steve Nash stuff the last few days. Man, that guy, like, his eyes swollen shut one year against the Spurs.
Oh, that's right.
His nose is
gross.
Bleeding all over the place against the Spurs a different year. Guys just getting knocked all over the place.
Joe Johnson had the fractured orbital, though.
Yeah.
Where the full face mask, like, where you couldn't just, like, it was dangerous to play, I think, and, you know.
P.S. Speaking of face masks, you see what Sue Bird did last night.
I did not see the game.
Oh my God.
I'm sorry to say.
Sue Bird just eviscerated the Phoenix Mercury in the fourth quarter of a winner-take-all game, which was my favorite stat that I was not aware of until like 2 weeks ago, was that Diana Taurasi's team, well, Phoenix, was going into last night 13-0 in winner-take-all games.
Wow. That's an incredible
stat.
That
is so badass. Diana Taurasi. Forget all these NBA dudes. All these NBA dudes are good. Like LeBron's good. Oh, so they're all good. Diana Taurasi is a bad MF-er. Badder than all of them. She's badder than all of them. I'm out on Amari. Sorry.
All right.
I will tell you another. This guy just annoys people, and I can see his Hall of Fame case. Unless he just continues to pile up numbers for like six more years to the point that he makes it indisputable. Another guy who's going to cross into the 20,000 point, 10,000 rebound club very soon is LaMarcus Aldridge. And people are just annoyed by LaMarcus Aldridge, and he's already a six-time All-Star, five-time All-NBA, all in the West, 19 points per game for his career. He's going to make it. But I think, you know, people are going to have arguments about it.
This is an entertainment league, right? Like, all sports is entertainment. Like, I don't, let's not get ridiculous. But basketball, the NBA, we gravitate toward the stars who put on a show in one fashion or another. And so, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge falls into your Elton Brand category in some ways, or the Joe Johnson category, where the numbers are there, the production is there, the requisite, you know, awards and honors are there. You respect what he's done, and you just, he doesn't move you. No one's moved by LaMarcus Aldridge, with all apologies to LaMarcus Aldridge. Like, I mean, it doesn't diminish his greatness, but we can't avoid the fact that these Hall of Fame discussions, you know, whether it's Dwight and people just not liking him because of his attitude and his antics, or whether it's, you know, Joe Johnson striking people as kind of boring. I mean, those impressions drive these discussions. They frame these discussions, or they at least infiltrate them.
He's going to get up to at least 22 or 23,000 points. I don't know what else to tell you.
Yeah. Look, I'm not saying no. I'm just saying why it's an uninspiring and potentially contentious discussion.
It's going to be contentious.
I'm not even inspired enough to have this debate.
I just think it's going to be contentious. Do you have someone other than Weber who's out that you absolutely think should be in?
Mm.
We have a package on this coming out on ESPN, I think, tomorrow, where a bunch of us, six or seven of us, picked someone who fit that description. I have to say, I was not – someone got to Weber before I did. Someone responded to the group email and took Weber over me.
Wow. That's bold.
So I was.
You should have veto power if you wrote the definitive piece about why he should be in. Also, you're Zach fucking low.
Well, I was. I have to say, I was uninspired by my remaining choices, but I picked somebody anyway. Do you have anyone else?
I'm going to make Tony work overtime on the bleep button today.
Okay, yeah, you're really fired up here.
aside from Weber, who's one that again, like I said, there's a, the personal like bias is not even the right word, but because I saw so much of him so close for his key years, that's one that I'm really tuned in on. I honestly, off the top of my head, I don't know that there is one. And I'm not a, look, I'm also not like a big Hall of Fame debate guy, in part because of all the stuff I said earlier. Like the Hall of Fame debates are kind of like, you know, needlessly maddening because we don't really know what the standards are or what the rationale is for who makes it and who doesn't. But like, are there a couple others you could throw out? I'll give you my, my 2 cents.
People would throw out Chambers. Pelton will go to his grave arguing for Jack Sikma. And actually, Jack Sikma has a very good argument.
That's not just a Pacific Northwest thing.
He has a good argument. I picked I have to say I'm not super passionate about it, but I picked Rudy Tomjanovich because I do think there needs to be a place in the Hall of Fame for someone who, to kind of your point, who's just kind of in the ether for a long time. And so he's one of the greatest players in the history of the University of Michigan. People don't remember that. From Hamtramck, I think his hometown is. Wow. Second pick in the draft. He averaged 25 and 15 at Michigan. He's still the all-time leading rebounder at Michigan. 5-time All-Star. All people remember is he almost got killed by Kermit Washington. That's the only thing people remember.
Well, and the two championships that he was the
coach of. We'll get there. 5-time All-Star as a player. 13,000 career points, which is what Ginobili has. 5 All-Stars is what Weber has. Let's give him a couple more if his face doesn't get completely shattered. And he's a 2-time champion as a coach. Every coach who has won multiple championships is in, or either is in or active, and what we can say they would get in probably. With the caveat that 2 of those people are Bill Russell and Casey Jones, who are in as players and not coaches. So, but every coach that has won 2 as a coach is in one way or another. The active ones, are Kerr, who will get in. Pop, obviously. Is Pop in already? Pop's not in yet. No, Pop has refused. Sure. Pop has refused to be considered. And under the radar, Spo. Probably makes the Hall of Fame.
That's
down the line.
I'm fine with that. Yeah. How can you refuse to be, like, how is that even in your power? Like,
someone wrote about this recently that he just doesn't want to be nominated. Like, someone was going to nominate him, and he's told people, do not nominate me.
But you can't, like, some random person could nominate him, couldn't they? Like, they don't have to, like, also because it's
all. Why
don't
you try?
Maybe I will. I mean, also because it's all obscure and
write a little handwritten letter that's just in an envelope that said Hall of Fame and just address it to Hall of Fame. And whom it may concern.
I hereby nominate Greg Popovich.
It's like when Steve Carell says, I declare bankruptcy in the office.
I'll be in Springfield on Friday. I'll just like slip by, like when I see like Jerry Colangelo having breakfast somewhere, I'm just going to like slip it under his coffee cup or something.
Maybe it's a secret society thing where you have to like know a handshake to be able to nominate somebody. Were you in a secret society in college?
No. I was a journalist in college. I'm not going to be part of some secret society.
Yeah, I've seen some old photos of you from the college journalism days. Big glasses.
Oh yeah, yeah. Thank you, Dan Brown.
So I ordered. I just said Rudy T. Between college, the pros, and coaching, he's just been in the ether for a long time at a very high level. Put him in.
Right. No, and not just long time, but when we talk about the fact that it is a basketball Hall of Fame and not just an NBA Hall of Fame, and when you consider that people are voted in based on a collection of achievements across many different roles, everything you just mentioned, I didn't know his college numbers. That's incredible. So you take into account his college playing days, his professional playing days, and the 2 championships with Houston, why wouldn't he be? And that's, again, back to the question. All right, why is this a rhetorical question? Why wouldn't Rudy Tomjanovich?
I believe he's been a finalist or whatever round is before the final. I don't know how, I don't remember.
No, and that part's all screwy too. So you and I can sit here and go, as a rhetorical question, why wouldn't Rudy T be in when everybody else who's won multiple championships and is, you know.
Well, and this is why people just make them wait. Just make them wait. Don't wait till they're dead. You know, Dennis Johnson got in. He was dead, I think, wasn't he? Didn't someone get in posthumously recently?
Yeah. But the fact that we can't answer the why isn't Rudy T in, that we don't have a definitive answer. I mean, if you want to know why Barry Bonds isn't in, there are a bunch of baseball writers who will tell you It's because of steroids. Like, okay, great. We don't have to agree with it, but at least we know why you didn't vote for him. We have, you and I can only sit here and ponder why Rudy T is not in.
Let's do one more. If the Warriors win next year, let's pretend it's not a fait accompli. I shouldn't say that. They did get taken to seven games. They did get taken to seven games by a team that probably won't be as good this year, but is also an unfinished product. I'm going to reserve judgment on Houston. I don't underestimate the Rockets' front office ability to surprise us. If they win, Andre Iguodala will be a four-time champion and a finals MVP.
Man, this one's tough.
Again, my taste in players, he's selfless. He plays defense. He's a brilliant. When people say he plays defense, there's effort and then there's anticipatory brilliance. That dude sees the game moving at a different speed and a different level than 99% of NBA players. He just is a savant. He's a brilliant player. He has 13,000 career points. He's somehow never won Sixth Man of the Year during this Warriors run. I voted for him at least once, if not twice. It's a crime that he didn't win one.
I think I've voted for him.
Manu only won once, I think.
Yes,
one time All-Star. No All-NBA appearances for Andre. I think even if they win again, he won't get in. I think the ultimate comparison to me would be Horace Grant. And a one-time All-Star, no All-NBA appearances. Same amount of points as of right now, and a four-time champion.
Because we are so
Iguodala is the super Robert Horry now. He's like the Robert Horry who actually deserves consideration for the Hall of Fame, because the real Robert Horry, apologies, great, but I loved Robert Horry. Again, think about the kind of players that I tend to gravitate to. He's just not a Hall of Famer. I'm sorry.
No, and one of my favorite guys to cover during those Laker years, and absolutely essential, and so many iconic shots for the Lakers and the Spurs. And the Rockets, by the way, for that matter.
Yeah. Young Robert Horry and young Sam Cassell balling out for the mid-90s Rockets.
We could make the case for Robert Horry because of, if we go back to my squishy argument about teams that define eras and guys that help define that, I mean, my God, like, he helped define two Rockets champions, three Laker champions, Spurs championship. It's no small thing. Robert Horry wasn't just along for the ride. I don't want to go down a tangent of Robert Horry's candidacy, but he wasn't just along for the ride with those teams.
No.
He was essential. And his defense, highly underrated, in those Laker years, by the way. Again, during a time when he had to battle Chris Webber, Rasheed Wallace, Tim Duncan, Dirk Nowitzki, and on and on and on. Kevin Garnett. But you asked about Andre Iguodala.
I did. Pretend he's a four-time champion with 14,000 points to his name.
I think that because he will be part of one of the most dominant teams we've ever seen.
As was Horace Grant.
But Horace was part of three championships. And
Four. One with the Lakers.
You're right. How could I forget that? But when we're talking about an era, the reason I brought it up that way was I'm thinking of one team. He's with this Warriors team that we've already discussed.
In fact, the point is you forgot the Lakers, and people have to look up, oh yeah, Horace Grant, Lakers, that's the thing that happened.
Right, no, he was
more... Won't forget the
Warriors. He was an ancillary player. Horace Grant was a key player for the Bulls for the three championships. He was an ancillary player for the Lakers. Iguodala has been an essential, incredibly essential part of this Warriors team, and the only reason we overlook him, you know, perpetually, even for things like Sixth Man of the Year, is because he doesn't have the box score numbers and because he's playing with these otherworldly talents.
And in many ways, Horace Grant is one good comparison, but in terms of how he's the start in case of emergency for the Warriors, Ginobili is another. I mean, he's not as good as Ginobili. He could not even touch Ginobili offensively, but in terms of counting stats and that sort of break in case of emergency starter thing for an all-time team, it's not, there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah, look, he's not going to make it, and probably when it comes right down to it, as much as we'd like to see him in there, shouldn't make it. But it does bring up one of the other things that we haven't really talked about much. We could have touched on this with Ben Wallace to an extent. Ben Wallace, we don't have to worry about how to quantify defense because Ben Wallace was a four-time defensive player, defensive player of the year, and a perennial all-defensive team guy, and he had blocks and rebounds, and you didn't have to worry about how to quantify that. We had traditional measures in place. You have spoken eloquently about Andre Iguodala's defensive otherworldliness and its value. But we still don't have a way to quantify it in the same way that we can say, oh, that guy scored 20 points a game for 10 straight years. Oh, that guy got 25,000 points in his career. Like, those are easy things to grasp and to build cases around. It's hard to build a case around Iguodala being a defensive savant because we don't have anything except...
Well, and also, I would like to go back, if I were voting, I would like to go back and look at all those defensive players. I mean, this is really hard to do and takes an enormous amount of work, but we just say it as if it's assumed that he deserved to win four Defensive Player of the Year awards, and maybe he did. I wonder if there were a couple years there, if I went back and looked at it, where I saw I actually would have voted for that guy, or actually would have, then if he's a two-time defensive player, but then there might be a couple years where he didn't win, where maybe you thought he should. Who knows?
Well, and again, to the point, back then, we didn't have any tracking stats. We didn't have any of the advanced metrics. We didn't have defensive win shares.
This is why Mitch Richmond is in.
Yeah.
Because he just put up a ton of numbers, and no one had league pass, and no one had any idea what he was actually doing on the floor. I mean, I wonder how, if Mitch Richmond had the exact same career he had today, I wonder how his case would have been litigated.
Yeah. No, it's fair. We are, when did this come up? Oh, the other day I was doing the Nerd Night podcast, and they brought up Shaq as a comparison point to DeMarcus Cousins based on what Cousins put up last year numbers-wise compared to Shaq in one of his prime years with the Lakers. And I said something to the effect of, yeah, you know, the thing is, the difference I draw between those two guys is that, you know, Cousins often has alienated a lot of his teammates, whereas Shaq, for all of his goofiness, was a magnet. He had this magnetism about him, this charisma. He drew players into him. Like, they wanted him to succeed. They wanted to feed him. So there was that element, but also defense. And so I said, you know, listen, I don't know what Shaq's defensive RPM or plus minus or defensive box, whatever. But they had already looked it up. The guys doing the podcast and Cousins.
It's the Nerd Night podcast.
Right. And so Cousins and Shaq were very close these two seasons that they were comparing, in the defensive box plus minus, whatever when it was. The fact is, back then, we didn't have Basketball Reference. We didn't have stats.nba.com. We didn't have Synergy. We didn't have anything. So, yeah, a lot of this stuff, especially with regard to defense, the reason that Defensive Player of the Year so often has been bigs instead of guards, historically, I think is because it was so much easier to go like, oh, that guy led the league in rebounding or defensive rebounds and blocked shots. Those were the only numbers we had. And, you know, occasionally you look at steals. Oh, so Gary Payton got one. There's more than that. Gary Payton was a freaking phenomenal defender, steals or no steals. But those are the only things you had to measure. And, yeah, it's a different discussion today.
All of these guys will be interesting, and in 3 or 4 years there will be other polarizing guys that are far enough into their careers that we can start talking about Blake Griffin and guys like that.
Derrick Rose, who you would put on the list initially.
Derrick Rose has less than Derrick Rose is out.
No, he's out, but he's going to be the first MVP ever not to make it.
Simmons,
right?
And I had a long email thread about this the other day, and he thinks Derrick Rose will get in. He thinks the voters
really?
Have become so squishy that everyone, all these borderline dudes, will get in, whoever the voters are. I don't think Derrick Rose will get in. The Hall of Fame is this weekend, Friday, tomorrow night in Springfield. Doris Burke is getting the Kurt Gowdy Media Award,
along with Full 48 podcast guest Andy Bernstein.
That's right. And so I will be there for that. I don't know Andy, obviously. I talk to him at games. If I don't know him well, he was just on your podcast. That is in my phone ears. That's in my ear holes for the subway ride home. Doris, congratulations. I can't wait to see you. And soon the real games. We could talk about real games pretty soon, real teams. It's
like,
time.
You know what's funny? Like, I scrolled on my Apple iCal calendar on my computer that has, like, I've plugged in Knicks and Nets through, like, that app that throws in schedule,
yeah,
holidays and all that stuff. And I always throw in Knicks and Nets just so I know when the home games are.
Right.
Because this is my backyard. That's when I'm going to go see teams. And, a Knicks-Nets exhibition game popped up, like, within view, like it was on
no,
my screen.
No, not yet. Knicks Nets exhibition game. No.
I'm so completely not ready for a Knicks Nets exhibition game, but there it was.
Howard Beck, you can read him at Bleacher Report. You can listen to his podcast, The Full 48, one of the very, very best. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I will see you not at that exhibition game. I won't see you there. I will not be there.
I might see you in Springfield.
Yes. The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.